right. Genesis 42. Genesis 42. And don't have anything new to put on the screen, so we're not going to use that tonight. But we have discovered, of course, Joseph's brothers have come to him in Egypt. So the famine is raging on, and they're really just into it. They still have several more years to go. We'll discover a little bit later on that when the brothers return home and then they go back to Egypt, that at that time they're only still in the second year of the famine. So they're really just getting started with the famine. They got a long ways to go in it. And it's amazing how devastating something like that can be in a short period of time. You understand why I said a few classes ago how that if it wasn't for God and Him intervening, that famine would have wiped them out. Because, again, they're already in a desperate situation. And it's at this point in Genesis 42, we can't be sure, but I imagine they're barely a year into it or so. We don't know how long, and we're not there yet. But when the brothers actually go back home and tell Jacob everything that happened in Egypt, we don't know how long they stay there before they return, but a good while, which is a little bit surprising, because as we'll see, one of the brothers are left back there in prison, and it seemed like they pretty much take their sweet time to go back and get them, and so we'll get to that here probably next week. But anyway, here in chapter 42, again, We left off with the brothers before Joseph, and there's a lot of things we could say, we've already said about Joseph, what a great man he was. But one of the things we probably should have pointed out or spent more time on it is just the good character of Joseph with regard to his view and attitude towards his brothers. He did not hold a grudge against them. And that's pretty impressive. You know, a lot of people, every time someone offends them, they have a little list that they put you on. You have a little list for people? I hope not. But that's normal. I mean, people, not, you know, just a mental list. People offend them, sin against them, and they're lodged in the mind. And that's just the world. I've often said, though, even in the church, we have to be very careful about that, because you get a congregation full of grudge holders, full of people who won't forgive, and you got a big problem, don't you? Because, as I've said, the church is made up of people, and we sometimes offend each other and make some mistakes with regard to our relationships. And when people are easily offended or people hang on to things, then you got a real problem. And Joseph is a great example. He's sort of, in a lot of ways, he's like Christ, but he certainly is in that regard. Maybe more than any other Bible character. Like, we know all about Jesus and his willingness to forgive, even when he was on the cross. Forgive them, Father. They know not what they do. Jesus didn't hold on to things. And so Joseph is a great example of that very thing. And as we go through this narrative, the next couple of chapters, it'll become very clear that he still has a lot of brotherly love for his brothers. And so it's just amazing. That's really remarkable after all that they put him through. Everything he's gone through is because of them. And it's amazing that he moved on from that. And not only right now, but throughout the situation, wasn't bitter, and again, didn't hold a grudge. One of the passages that I love, if you turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, you know the passage on love, of course, but one of the things, the definitions that he gives of love, and as you're turning over there, remember, this is Paul personifying love, telling us exactly how it acts. He pictures love as a person, and this is how it behaves. And he begins the chapter by letting us know that without love, we're nothing. So you have to love. You must love your brothers and sisters. You must love everyone. And because of this chapter right here, there is no mistake about whether or not you love. Because here's Paul saying, this is how you act. This is how love behaves. And either you behave this way or you don't. And of course, we don't have time to, there's this one definition that I want to get at here. But at verse 4, he says, love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on having its own way. And then it says, it is not irritable or resentful. And that word right there, the ESV says resentful. I think some of your translations, the King James maybe, I don't know about the New King James, but says it thinketh no evil. And that actually is a good definition of the word if you know what's meant by that. It's kind of misleading because when you think of, you know, love thinketh no evil, you view of evil just in general. And that's not really what the word means. The Greek word there, in fact, my ESV has in it a little footnote. It says, does not count up wrongdoing. And that's in the footnote. The Interlineal Bible simply does not keep record. And so it's the idea. It's really an accountant word. It's one of Paul's favorite words. He uses this word 34. It only appears 41 times in the New Testament, and Paul uses it 34 of the time. And a lot of times it's the idea of the imputing righteousness, that sort of thing. The word impute comes from the same word. But anyway, it has to do with the idea of logging something up in your mind, making a record of something, keeping track of something. And so Paul says it doesn't do that. Love, in other words, doesn't make a list. It doesn't have a list of people that has offended them in some kind of way. And so this is the way love behaves. Like, we can't do that and be a Christian. You just can't. And so, and you think about Joseph, man, what kind of list could he have made? You think of everyone that could have been on his list. He certainly, his brothers, without a question, they would have been on that list because they threw him in a pit. And then the Ishmaelites, they might have even been on the list because they bought him and then sold him into Egypt. How many people would have had them on the list? Like, you know, I hate Ishmaelites. You know, it doesn't matter if they weren't a part of the caravan. It doesn't matter. He's an Ishmaelite. I don't like him. You know, he could have put them. And then Potiphar's wife would have been on his list, and Potiphar too, because he believed his wife. And the butler would have been on his list because he forgot about him. And just think of the long list. Joseph, if you want to talk about someone who could have been a bitter man, that's Joseph certainly could have been. But now, as all these years later, as the brothers appear before him, it's very obvious he wasn't a list keeper. He didn't think in those terms at all. And in fact, think about the power that Joseph is in and what he could have done to his brothers if he wanted to. If he was a grudge holder, they'd have been in deep trouble, wouldn't they? I mean, he could have done anything he wanted. He could have had them executed on the spot. He could have had them tortured. He could have just had them in prison for the rest of their life. Anything he wanted. He's the second in command in all of Egypt. Nobody would have thought twice about anything he did to his brothers. And yet we'll find instead he's compassionate and has compassion towards them. And it's really remarkable. Like, again, it's easy when we go through all of this and we read about these people in the Bible, we see them. And this is the way we ought to behave. But in real life, it's a lot easier to be a list maker. And more people than not are like that. Hold grudges. Just can't let things go. And so Joseph is a remarkable example to us. He's like Christ. And that's the way we need to be. And so now, as we turn over to Genesis chapter 42, that doesn't mean, again, that he is testing his brothers. And so he does some things that really are necessary. He has to find, Joseph is trying to find some way to determine whether or not his brothers have changed. And that's pretty important. Like, if they're ever going to come to Egypt, he wants to know if, you know, are they the same kind of men that they were 20 years ago when they threw me into the pit? Or have they changed? Have they grown at all? Has their heart changed at all? And it seems as if, at least, he's trying to determine that in all the things that he does. And so they stand before him, and he speaks to them harshly, and he accuses them of being spies. They, as we saw last week, they don't recognize him, but he immediately recognizes them. And so he accuses them again of being spies, and they immediately deny it. Verse 10 says, "No, my Lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." And he said to them, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Egypt. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." So if I'm not mistaken, that's about where we left off last time. And I was making the point as we closed the class that they're kind of panicking here. And, you know, rightfully so. We understand why they are fearful right now. The worst case scenario, really, in their mind, is coming to pass. They just want to get to Egypt, get their food, get their grain, and get back home, give it to their father so everybody can be fed and all of that, and hopefully without any problems. But instead, there's all of a sudden a problem. Out of nowhere, they're accused of being spies. And now this important person, I don't know that they realized how important Joseph is. They may. But anyway, they're standing before a very important Egyptian master here. And all of a sudden, he's accusing them of being spies. So they're panicking a little bit. But sometimes when you panic, you talk too much. You say too much. And they give information that they really didn't have to give. And it gets them in a little bit of trouble. It's kind of pseudo trouble. It's not real trouble because we know that this is really Joseph, but they don't know that. So they just think it's an Egyptian master, someone in great authority in Egypt, and they should have been a little more careful with their words. Like, it's, you know, when they start opening up and saying, "Oh yeah, we're just, you know, our father's back home and our brother is there," they're giving information that could be dangerous. They don't know. This could be a wicked, evil man before them. And they're sharing news about their family back home. Wouldn't you, in that kind of situation, the last thing you want to do is start giving up out information about your family. You know that, but that's what they do. Later on, we'll find that Jacob isn't happy about the situation at all. He blames them. "The only reason that man in Egypt knows anything about my boy Benjamin is because of you all." And that's exactly right. Exactly right. But from Joseph's standpoint, he's thrilled. Because it's a good chance that he's already given some thought. Again, he knows that these are his brothers. So where's Benjamin? And it would be natural to pop into his mind, you know, it's possible they've done something to Benjamin just like they did to me. It's good news when he hears, "Oh, my father is alive." He finds that out because he's been gone 20 years. How would he know if his father was even still living? And so, but now because of them, he knows that. And he also knows that Benjamin's okay. He's just at home with the father. And so Joseph immediately begins to put together this plan, how he is going to see his brother again. And so, at verse 14, he says, Joseph says to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And you see just how quick Joseph can think. He thought right away, they mentioned Benjamin, and he knows, I know how I can see my brother again. And so this is what he quickly comes up with. And so there they are to send one back to get him. And if they don't bring him back, then they'll all probably be executed or at least enslaved for the rest of their lives because they are indeed spies. And again, we know the story, and Joseph knows that they're not spies, but he is testing them. It'd be a very interesting development. Will they actually bring the boy back? Will they be willing to do that? And so that's what he does. And then he says he puts them all together in custody for 3 days. Isn't that ironic? Joseph been in prison, been in this terrible situation all these years, and now the ones who are responsible, now they are in custody themselves. And that word custody there, really, they're imprisoned. That's the same word that described Joseph's imprisonment back in chapter 40, verse 4. And so they are imprisoned for 3 days. What did they do for those 3 days? What did they think about? We're not told, but we can imagine. This is not a good time for them at all. They're probably terrified. They don't know, even though Joseph has said, this is what we're going to do, where you send someone back and the rest of you will stay here until he gets back. But who knows? What if somehow they just conclude during any time during this 3 day period that they are spies? They might want to come in at any time and just execute them. So they're sitting there in prison now, probably terrified for their life. They don't know what is really going to happen. And then finally, Joseph, after 3 days, he comes back. On the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you shall live. And so right away, he gives them a little bit of comfort there. At least they know he's going to follow through and not kill us if we do what he tells us to do. And then he says something surprising that should have, at least, I don't know how much comfort it gave them, but it should have given them a lot of comfort. He on the third day, he says, do this and you shall live, for I fear God. And as we've said in other places, it's typical. It's the case here. There's an article there in the Hebrew meaning the God. He is referring to the God, and they knew it. And Elohim is the word there, but it, whenever the article is there, it's almost always talking about the one true God. And we know Joseph, that would be the one, of course, he was referring to. And so they would know it. One translation at least says, I fear God too. And so clearly he was talking about the God of heaven, and they knew that. So that should have been comforting, shouldn't it? Joseph saying, it seems like this is a little bit more private setting. He goes in there to him again after 3 days and says, don't worry, you do this and you shall live because I fear God just like you all fear God. And so now I suppose it depends on their level of spirituality, how much comfort that would give them. But to me, that seems like that should give them a lot of comfort that he has that same fear of God that they have. And then Joseph changes the scenario just a little bit. He says, do this and you shall live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain to the famine of your household. And so what did he change right there? What did he change? Right. Now, instead of keeping all of them in prison, just one of them has to be in prison. And so nine of them get to go home. And so why he changed his mind on that, we're not told. I have no idea. But he comes back after 3 days and he changes that up a little bit. But notice that they have really, with all of this going on, they're really involved in reflection, thinking about their situation, and as they do, they can't help but to think about Joseph. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
He with the knowledge that Joseph had, because God was with him, he may have said, you know, keep one over here, take the grain back, because he knew there was family there.
Right.
He knew his kid brother was there.
Yeah.
He knew his father was there.
Yes.
And all of the other family. So that may have played a part in it. He wanted to get the
right
back there because he recognized the situation.
Right. There's no question that this whole thing was, what he did here is an act of brotherly love. It's one of the things that tells me, as I have been saying, it's clear in this narrative that he still loves his brethren. And I think what Dale says is right. It's probably, no doubt, his mind would be heavily on his father and his one full brother, on Benjamin. But there's good indication that even these brethren before him, that he has a great deal of sympathy and strong feelings for them. And again, I don't want to overstate, but that to me is just remarkable, and just a great example for all of us. But yeah, a lot of this is, and throughout this we'll see he really loves his family, and so all right. But notice there what they do after they he comes back and he changes the plan up a little bit. And he says, at verse 20, and bring your youngest son to me, so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. But look at verse 21. It says, and then they said one to another, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. This is why this distress has come upon us. Now, we covered that. We jumped ahead, if you remember, when he was first thrown into the pit and looked at that verse. But again, that's amazing, the kind of men they were back there. Remember, when we read that back in the chapter before, not only did they hear him begging them to let him out of that pit, what did they do? What were they doing? Remember? They sat down and ate. Like, they could hear. We know from this verse, they could hear him begging, crying out, please let me out. And they're just eating. Are you surprised that Joseph has to kind of figure out, I wonder if these men have changed any? Because that's who they used to be. That's what they did. But now here they are here, and they come out of this custody. They're all together, and they basically make a confession that they probably have never made before. Like, here they are collectively. There's a good chance, we can't be sure about this, but there's a good chance that they have never collectively got together and talked about Joseph. To them, he's no more. And, you know, when you do something as bad as what they did, so terrible, you just kind of want to forget about that. And it becomes obvious that it was something that at least in a real deep way bothered their conscience, that probably didn't come to the surface very often, but they deep inside they felt bad about that. But when you do something like that, you're like, you don't get together at a family potluck and talk about Joseph. There's a very good possibility that they never talked about Joseph, especially collectively. But all of this, what's going on to them now, it just reminds them, they imprisoned Joseph themselves by throwing him in a pit. Now here they are, and they get to thinking, this is payback. We're all of this is happening to us because of what we did to Joseph. But you notice again how clear-minded they are. How they notice, in truth, we are guilty. Like, they're admitting something. What's the first step towards repentance? What's the very first thing you have to do? Right. You have to take responsibility. You have to admit your sin. That's the only way you can have real repentance. Like, I hate when someone comes forward or something and they want the prayers of the church, and they say, you know, wait a minute. Right when "if" comes out, you know they're not taking responsibility. They're not acknowledging guilt. You think about Joseph's brothers, all that they could have done on this occasion. They're reminded of Joseph now. They could have said, you know, really? It was Jacob's fault. If he wouldn't have showed all this favoritism, we wouldn't have acted like we did and never would have done that. Or they could have even blamed Joseph. You remember, you know, he was arrogant after all. And I don't think he was, but they thought he was. And so they could have gone that route. Or they could have just started making excuses. Oh, you know, we at 20 years ago and we were young and we didn't have experience. That's why we did that. But they didn't do any of that, did they? Right here, they begin. Now, after all of this has happened to them, they really acknowledge exactly who was at fault. In truth, we are guilty. And that says something. They're taking at least baby steps forward in their character. And Joseph is impressed by that. I mean, here, as it goes on to say, they don't realize he understands what they're saying. Because there's an interpreter, and you know he's speaking through an interpreter. They don't think he understands, but he's listening to all of this and knows exactly what they're saying. But they really confess, yeah, they no one else to blame, and this is what they brought on themselves because in truth they indeed were guilty. Now there was one exception to that at verse 21, Reuben. Really didn't want to take full responsibility. It says, and Reuben answered them, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood. Which even those words kind of tell you that in their mind, when they say Joseph is no more, they pretty much think that he has died, that he certainly would not have survived all these years as a slave in Egypt, and they think that he indeed is no more. But Reuben comes forward and says, you know, I told you all not to do that. And, I mean, that you know, he did do that, didn't he? Is that accurate? Yeah, he did. He had a plan in his mind to put him, it was his idea to put him in the pit because he wanted to come back later and rescue him. But as I said at the time, that's not what Joseph needed. He needed a big brother. Reuben's the oldest of them all. He needed Reuben to stand up and say, stop, we're not going to do that. Well, this is terribly wrong. And he should have stepped in and rescued Joseph. Instead, he was cowardly, and he wanted to sneak in at night when the other brothers wouldn't realize it and secretly rescue Joseph. And as a result of his plan, he got sold into Egypt before he can pull that off. And so, but now he's bringing this up. The other brothers are saying, you know, in truth, we're guilty. And Reuben said, wait a minute, I told you all not to do this. And so he's not really, he doesn't have the same, quite level of guilt as the others. I'm sure he feels bad about the situation and everything, but still, he wants to remind them of that. Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? Now, verse 23, they did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. And then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. All of this is, again, he's testing them. He didn't have to do it just like that. But, you know, that makes the best effect on the whole thing. He wants them to be terrified. He wants to see what they're going to do. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. And again, so he didn't have to do all that either. He obviously gave him the money back. He loved his family and gave them provisions. I seriously doubt that everyone, all these people coming from all over Canaan and all the places that are hit by the famine, that they would come and then the Egyptians would give them provisions for their trip back home. But Joseph loves his family, even these brothers, after all that they have done. And so That's what he does. But as they're going home, it says, as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. And he said to his brothers, my money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack. At this, their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, what is this that God has done to us? And so they don't know what to make of that. Why do you think they're so fearful? Like, if you saw the money back in your sack, wouldn't you be kind of excited about that? Right, right, right. Looks like they're being set up. And so they trembled over that. But Joseph, he just loves them. So he wanted to return all the money back to them. All right. So verse 29, and when they came to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, the man, the Lord of the land, spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, we are honest men. We have never been spies. We are 12 brothers, son of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. Now, Jacob says nothing, but that made him mad. Like, what in the world? Why did you tell that man in Egypt about me and your brother? And even where we live. So later on here, in just a little bit here, you'll see that he blames them for what has befallen them now. Because this is not good news at all for Jacob. He's already lost Joseph. And now Simeon. And why, by the way, did Joseph pick Simeon? We're not told. So really don't have any idea. But now, for all practical purposes, he has lost Simeon. Unless they take Benjamin back with them. And it kind of seems like Jacob understands that at this point, they don't really have too many options here. Because these brothers opened their big mouths and had to say something about Benjamin. So he's going to again call them on that. He says, verse 34, bring your youngest brother to me. Then I shall know that you are not spies, but honest men. And I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land. Now, I want you to notice right here, right there at that place, what does Jacob say? Right there at the end of verse 34 in your Bible, what does Jacob say? Doesn't say anything, does he? He's going to respond a little bit later, but right here, he doesn't say anything. And I just bring that out to you because I want you to picture these Bible stories really are amazing. It's real life stuff. I mean, these are real men, and this happened. So here they are. They give Jacob this bad news. The only way they're going to get Simeon back and the only way they're going to get any more food is if they will send Benjamin back to Egypt. And so there's silence. You can just picture them sort of, they break this news and they don't say anything. Jacob doesn't respond. They just sit there and contemplate the situation. You ever been in that kind of situation? Have a family problem or difficulty and where you're just sitting with your family and really there's not, you just sit there. Like, what do we do? And that's kind of the situation that they're in. There's nothing to say. And then the silence is broken when finally they begin to empty their sacks. And it says, and they emptied their sacks, and behold, every man's bundle of money was in the sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. Like they trembled when they thought just one of the brothers' money was back. Now they discovered they all had their money back. And Jacob, their father, said to them, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me. And now he's thinking, after this little bit of development, he's thinking, there is no way I'm sending Benjamin back. No, I'm not doing that. Because now he doesn't know what to think. It doesn't look real good. Here, the brothers go, and he kind of knows their character from the past anyway, and they go, and they're supposed to buy some grain, and they have this situation with this great man in Egypt, and they come back, and they have the grain, and they have all their money. What would you think if you were Joseph, if you were Jacob? What have you all done? I mean, as far as he knows, they pulled something off here. And now they might just bring the wrath of Egypt upon them. He doesn't know. At the least, they again were set up. And no matter what, they're in trouble. I'm not sending my only child left from Rachel. I am not sending him back with you to Egypt. No way. And so he's decided, he's not doing that. My son shall not go back. Verse 38. My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol. And so he determines, no, he's not going back. And yet if he doesn't, they're in deep trouble. He, in the end, we'll get into 43 next week, but we'll find he realizes finally, after some time goes by, it kind of seems like it could be close to a year that passes. And so, but a good period of time passes to where finally they again are desperate for food, and something's going to have to be done. And plus Simeon is sitting in jail all this time. And so if they want him back, they're going to have to send Benjamin. And Jacob finally comes to that realization. And so we'll talk about that next week. I guess he knew something, huh? What did I know of? I better check, huh? I don't think so, though.